So as you can tell, today is the Feast of All Saints, a time when the church remembers all those faithful saints and souls who have come before us, our elders and ancestors in faith, foremothers and forefathers upon whose shoulders we sometimes rather shakily stand. It's a feast that reminds us that there's something more than we can actually see, something beyond the workaday plane of reality. We live in a time, I think, when rational thought rules the day and where the idea of a spirit world is rejected by even quite a portion of the church as a petty superstition, something we used to believe. And yet, somehow that view that there is a world of spirit continues to be strong in the worldviews and spiritualities of indigenous folk. So much of the experience of people in the global south, in the two-thirds world, and even, I would suggest, in the spiritual but not religious crowd. So with all that, I wonder if it's not time for us to take some cues from those folks and to reclaim and be proud of some of our ancient birthright as a deeply spiritual people who indeed live with feet firmly planted on this blessed ground, but also believe in a truly enchanted world of angels and saints, and to not shy away from the transcendent. And so it is on this day that we hear ancient readings like Erefin read from the book of Revelation, readings which posit what an old hymn calls the mystic sweet communion, a fellowship divine, happening somewhere beyond the great veil. It's in that surreal cosmic vision where John the Revelator paints a vivid picture of a vast multicultural multitude. And how strange and countercultural that must have been in his age. He suggests that we are somehow in the here and now connected to elders and ancestors in faith who are actively worshiping the Lamb of God, that is the crucified and risen one, somewhere beyond the veil. It's no accident, I think, that the great tradition of the church sees this time of year, All Saints and All Souls, as a time when the veil between those realities is thinnest, where worlds of matter and spirit, though we believe always intertwined and interwoven, are experienced as just that much closer to each other. It serves to remind us that the church is not merely a social club, a Sunday morning obligation, or even a set of rituals to make sense of our lives in the changes and chances of this world, but at best is a bridge to a bigger reality, a reality where saints and martyrs gather around the throne of the Creator in songs of endless praise. And as much as I love that challenge that we are connected with all the saints, I also get just a wee bit nervous on this feast day. I worry about our tendency to put so-called saints on pedestals and how that diminishes the very gritty and real earthiness that they embodied. And perhaps more tragically, negates the fact that they were as broken and anxious and messed up and hurting, that is, as human, as the rest of us. Dorothy Day, one of my saints, was right then to cheekily say, "Don't call me a saint. I don't want to be dismissed that easily." I love then that the church in its wisdom from ancient times until today has chosen its readings to contrast that resplendent mystical vision of Revelation of the shiny white-robed saints worshiping around the throne with the gritty earthly reality of the Beatitudes. So with that cosmic hope and heavenly worship contrasted with the fleshy broken-hearted now, I can't help but be reminded of a quote from Brennan Manning that I just love. "A saint is not someone who is good, but who recognizes the goodness of God." A saint is not someone who is good, but who recognizes the goodness of God. The brokenheartedness, the inner poverty, the hunger and weeping that Jesus calls blessed in the gospel, it is not something to ascribe to or strive for like a checklist. And yet I do think that those who face that broken reality in their lives, and I imagine most of us do on some level, or orient their lives in solidarity with the suffering, are somehow strangely and paradoxically opened to the goodness of God. Theologians have called this God's preferential option for the poor, and that's a concept that's hard to deny if you take the Beatitudes seriously. The more that I delve into the stories of some of my heroes of the faith, the more that that reality of sainthood feels evident. Beyond the veneer that we want to paint them with, they were as often as tarnished and broken and struggling as I am. The writer Philip Yancey talks about being kind of internally paralyzed by the Sermon on the Mount for years, thinking that those blessed statements were some kind of ideal to live up to, a kind of need to be seeking to be poor and persecuted, to almost have a martyr complex, per se. He shares that a kind of evolving understanding of grace changed the way he read those Beatitudes, and he now reads it not as a to-do list or a to-strive-toward list, but instead a mirror of the image of God revealed in Jesus, the crucified one, poor, brokenhearted, hungry, excluded, who gave up all and forgave to reconcile all things. That is, to use the image in Revelation, as a broken lamb whose blood makes us whole. Difficult imagery, by the way, but imagery I think that's worth kind of holding with and chewing on a little bit. The end part of that reading in Luke's Gospel about the need for forgiveness, of turning the other cheek, of giving your cloak to your oppressor, is perhaps even more dangerous than our tendency to put saints on pedestals. I think there's a danger in reading it, and I fear that the church has done this, and perhaps some of us as well. There's a danger in thinking that we should just become doormats, or that the poor should just kind of accept their lot and just kind of, you know, take it as it comes. I actually think that a careful reading of the text suggests that the opposite is true. Walter Wink suggests that the Sermon on the Mount, the Beatitudes, and the call to forgive, to give up our cloak, to love our enemies, to turn the other cheek, is nothing short of a means of exposing and inverting what he calls the domination system. I suggest today that to love our enemies and to bless those who oppress us is, in part, actually about disarming them in their power. No, it's not to let their hate or violence or oppression have the final say. And to forgive them is by no means to allow them to get away with their oppression. But it is also not to allow their violence to take over our whole beings, to allow their actions of oppression and violence to envelop us in the anger and in the cycle of violence that we are all so familiar with in this world. Again, it's just to disarm their power over us. And if there is one thing that saints do, saints alive and dead, saints here and there, that we might perhaps seek to follow in their steps, is that they are opened to the possibility of that kind of surrender, of forgiveness, of a whole different way of being that we hear about throughout the gospel. It's a way of radical surrender and nonviolence that is cruciform, a life lived in the very shape of a cross. It's about recognizing one's own blessedness in God's sight and the goodness of God in that. Not the God of the Caesars of this world. That writing in Revelation is actually quite a counterpoint. Caesar was the lion, and the people there, they're worshiping the lamb. Not the gods of the domination system, but of the one God who stretched out arms in love on a cross to redeem the entire cosmos. The God who became human, the lion who became both lamb and shepherd at once, the reading tells us. Now, isn't that good news? But let's face it, life is still difficult, first of the four noble truths, the Buddhists tell me. And we note in our midst, there are those who are suffering deeply right now. And so we hear Jesus' words again, blessed are the poor and the brokenhearted. And even as we hear those words, it is good news that we live intertwined with an enchanted world where indeed our foremothers and forefathers of all ages continue to have their lives ever interwoven with our own. It's good news that as we live in the midst of our own broken saintliness, God will lead each and every one of us to springs of living water and wipe away every tear. So with that promise on our hearts this morning, I invite you to just take a very short moment to remember a saint who has lived into this recognition of the goodness of God, and who thus perhaps moved you a little bit in transforming your life. Perhaps it's someone you knew. Perhaps it's one of the great saints of history. So just take a second and do that. Bring to mind one of those people who is a saint for you. As you hold that person in your heart, as you remember, give thanks for their life and witness. Give thanks to God that they are closer to us, even here and now, closer than we can even begin to imagine, pointing us always toward the infinite and unending goodness of God.